Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1, a transitional year resident, that's ultimately going to be going into radiology. This will be the 80th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And really, in today's episode, I'll be continuing my discussion of hematology and oncology. This is probably more a hematology podcast. And yesterday, I know I started talking about like the two cascades, like the primary hemostasis, secondary hemostasis, talked about all of that. And then I integrated a lot of diseases along the way. So I'm going to sort of like use this podcast to like really hone in on those diseases. Make sure we talk about the high yield details for most of them. And then I'll also talk about a bunch of new diseases that basically kind of like involve platelets, that I did not necessarily mention yesterday. And then in the next podcast, we'll begin to go more into like the red blood cell stuff, the white blood cell stuff, the cancer stuff, and sort of go from there. Again, like I said, under the podcast yesterday, there's already podcasts for heme pharmacology and onc pharmacology, right? So I need to cover those again. If you just sort of go down in the website, you'll find them in one of the older episodes. Okay, so let me sort of, again, same format as yesterday, I'll start with a case, right? So let's assume you get a question about a patient that is, 50 years old, right? And this person has some kind of hematologic malignancy, okay? So they are, in the process of treating that hematologic malignancy through, let's say they are doing like some kind of surgical procedure or biopsy or something. The person, kind of becomes unresponsive. And you check some basic labs and you notice that their hemoglobin that was like 12 when they came into the hospital is now like 8 or 7. And their platelet count is also like super low and all their hematologic labs are kind of like all screwed up, right? So their PT is high, their PTT is high, their bleeding time is high, their fibrinogen is low, they have schistocytes on blood smear, all that stuff, right? If you see that, I really hope you're thinking about DIC, right? And hopefully you're thinking about that's the thing about step one, right? Again, these USMLE exams, yeah, don't get me wrong, I'm not going to downplay the fact that they're tough, right? But it's all about just being able to put things together, right? So hematologic malignancy, DIC. I really hope you're thinking about acute promyelocytic leukemia, right? So remember, acute promyelocytic leukemia, that's where you have the 15-17 translocation, right? And remember that that's where you classically have the hour rods within your myeloid cells. And those hour rods, right, say for example, if they spill into the circulation, they can actually activate the coagulation cascade. And if that happens, guess what? You run into DIC, right? I mean, there are other classic... So basically, if you sort of see my thought process with this, you can see how your friends at the MBME can construct many USMLE questions, right? So, for example, they can give you a question about a pregnant woman that delivers a baby or she has had, like, prolonged rupture of membranes. She delivers a baby and then becomes unresponsive, right? You're probably thinking about like amniotic fluid embolism with that. Because remember, there are many constituents of amniotic fluid that, again, can just sort of be released into the circulation and cause this massive activation of the coagulation cascade. Another classic way they can test this is in a patient that has... like preeclampsia, right? So remember, again, preeclampsia, remember that spectrum, like preeclampsia, eclampsia, HELLP syndrome, all that stuff, right? All those things can ultimately cause, the milieu around the amniotic fluid can, at least some contents of the amniotic fluid and some stuff in the uterus can, again, trigger the coagulation cascade and cause a lot of trouble, right? Another classic one that may show up is a woman that, they say, 5 days ago, her baby stopped moving, right? And then she was like, that's kind of weird. Let me come to the hospital. And then sometime during her hospitalization, the lady becomes unresponsive, right? The thing that happened is whenever you have like a dead fetus, right, that can, again, That's why you don't, I mean, you can, if a lady, for example, has a dead fetus, right, the responsible thing you should do as a physician is, you know, show your empathy and all that stuff. But one thing you need to remember is you cannot sit on it, right? You need to get that baby out as quickly as possible, because guess what? Those constituents of the amniotic fluid and the uterus, again, can cause a massive activation of the coagulation cascade, and you can run into DIC very quickly in those patients. So basically, right, this case that I just mentioned is basically raising in the setting of a DIC. So the diagnosis here is DIC, right? So DIC, it's kind of like a weird condition. But basically, I'll say, if you want to think about pathophysiology, almost always the thing that happens is you have some substance that's released into the circulation that can cause like massive activation of the coagulation cascade, right? And as that happens, right, you begin to deplete your platelet, so you get a thrombocytopenia. As you begin to you know, keep activating your coagulation cascade, you form all these like platelet thrombi in your blood vessels. So as your red blood cells sort of move through those blood vessels, those platelet thrombi sticks begin to shear those red blood cells. And if you think about it, right, as you shear those red blood cells, you'll have an anemia, right? So your red blood cell count will go down, your hemoglobin will go down. Other things that will happen will be that because your red blood cells are exploding, right, the contents of red blood cells, right, so like LDH, right, they'll begin to be spilled into the circulation. So your lactate dehydrogenase will go up. Remember, LDH is heavily expressed in red blood cells, because remember, red blood cells don't have mitochondria, right? So they only do like anaerobic metabolism. Hopefully that's something you remember from the biochem video. And then right, because you're constantly turning over your platelets, again, your platelet count goes down, your red blood cell count goes down, your LDH goes up, right? Because you're shearing your red blood cells, you see a lot of schistocytes on a blood smear, right? Other high yield things that may happen is in the process of DIC, you also begin to activate plasmin a lot, right? So all that plasmin can begin to chop up your fibrin. And remember, the one of the breakdown products of fibrin, they're called like fibrin degradation products, and a specific subset of them is your D-dimer, right? So your D-dimer will be massively elevated in the setting of DIC, right? And if you think about it, right, again, DIC, I sort of think of it as a condition where you're making a ton of fibrin, but you're also breaking down a ton of fibrin, right? And remember, if you're making a ton of fibrin, fibrin is the activated form of fibrinogen. So if you keep making fibrin, you're forming clot, you're breaking down that clot. It's like you're thrombosing your blood vessels, but you're also sort of bleeding out, because you're also getting, in that massive activation of your coagulation cascade, you are using up your platelets at an accelerated clip, right? So that thrombocytopenia can predispose you to bleeding, okay? So because you're making all these clots, right, remember, if you want to make a strong platelet plug, you need to convert factor 1, which is fibrinogen, to factor 1a, which is fibrin, which is on, and remember, that is all under the control of thrombin, right, factor 2a. So if you keep using up your fibrinogen to make fibrin, you can already see that your fibrinogen levels should be low in the setting of DIC. So that's kind of like all I'll say about a DIC. I guess I'll go ahead and move on from that. So again, I have like an outline of what I want to discuss, like just list of topics. So you may say, why are you saying all these ums and ahs? Again, I apologize. I'm just basically kind of making this from memory. Okay. So we talked about the von Willebrand disease yesterday. We talked about the hemophilias. Remember yesterday I said I will talk about like the different the differences between platelet bleeding and clotting factor bleeding. So platelet bleeding, right? So those people who tend to have like very heavy menses, right? So one of the most classic presentations of von Willebrand disease on an exam is a lady that just has just really bad menorrhagia. Also like nosebleeds, you know, or like skin findings like petechiae, purpura. If you see those things, you want to think more about platelet problems, right? So like von Willebrand disease, where you have a deficiency of von Willebrand factor, or like Bernard-Soulier disease, right, where you have a deficiency of GP1B, or what is this thing called? Glanzmann thrombocytopenia, right, where you have a deficiency of GP2B3A. And then also remember ITP, immune thrombocytopenia, right, where you have a deficiency. I mean, sorry, not deficiency. You make autoantibodies against the GP2B3A, okay? Those things are basically affecting platelets, so you should observe a platelet pattern of bleeding in those patients. Contrast that with hemophilias, right, where classically hemophilias on exams may present as like arthritis, right? So like those kind of describe like a young person that has like osteoarthritic features, right? Because of just, they're just bleeding into their joints, right? So the buzzword for that on exams is a hemarthrosis, right? Or they tell you that, oh, this person had like a procedure, like a dental procedure, and they had like life-threatening bleeding afterwards that required like transfusion. And you really want to think about a clotting factor disorder, right? Because the thing is, in general, platelet disorders, they cause like, you know, like just kind of like small bleeds, right? So like micro hemorrhages. But if you have a clotting factor disorder, you can have like big bleeds, right? Like macro hemorrhages. You can get into trouble relatively quickly. And then so that's how you sort of differentiate between the different kinds of the platelet bleeding, where again you have more of like an elevation in your bleeding time and your clotting factor bleeding, right? And remember, I mentioned yesterday that I guess we can even run through this real quick, right? So if a patient bleeds a lot and their bleeding time is elevated, their erythrocytic cofactor assay is abnormal, and their PTT is elevated, right, that should tell you that they have what? That will be von Willebrand's disease. Again, I talked about the pathophys behind all that stuff in the podcast from yesterday. And then, what if a patient has an elevated PTT, okay, and it's a girl on tests, and the PT is normal, the bleeding time is normal? What does that tell you? Good, that has to be hemophilia C, right? That's the factor 11 deficiency. Remember, that's inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion. But what if a patient has elevated PTT, normal bleeding time, it's a boy, right? The PT is fine, the bleeding time is fine. Hopefully that tells you that that's hemophilia A or B, okay? Because remember, those are X-linked recessive inheritance, so they are only common in boys, right? I mean, actually, on MBMA exams, they should never happen in girls, only in boys, okay? And again, if they give you a question where it's nondescript and you're like, yeah, this is a legit hemophilia, and they give you hemophilia A and B, both in the answer choices, go with hemophilia A, because again, it's a lot more common than hemophilia B. And we talked about the treatment of like hemophilia A, for example. I mean, alternatively, you can also give like, you know, basically give them back what they've lost, right? So like recombinant like factor 8 for hemophilia A, or factor 9 for hemophilia B, or factor 11 for hemophilia C. And then also, don't forget yesterday, I talked about where a patient may have like a hemophilia-like presentation, okay? But, and again, it's usually like a kid that's like less than 2 years old, but the PT is fine, the PTT is fine, the bleeding time is fine. If you see that, you really want to think about a factor 13 deficiency. It doesn't have a specific name, you just call it factor 13 deficiency. Just one of those weird, bizarre things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And again, I explained the pathophysiology behind all of that yesterday. Really, my purpose today is to try to bring all those disorders I discussed yesterday together. Yesterday, I was heavily focused on pathophysiology, but today I want to focus on making sure I sort of give you like the, again, just sort of remind you of the high yield salient points I discussed yesterday, and also talk about sort of like a bevy of new diseases. So, hopefully you understand those permutations I just discussed. I think that should make it a lot easier for, because if you, those are basically the labs, right? Like, oh, this is high, this is low, and then they'll give you these weird scenarios. Many times, if you sort of have the understanding based on what we discussed yesterday, you should be able to have no issues resolving these disorders in seconds on your exam. Now, let's assume you get a question, right, about a patient, right, that they said, you know, this guy, whenever he takes a shower, he begins to itch a ton, right? And let's assume he's like a 60-year-old guy. And then they tell you that, ah, you know what, this guy had, I don't know, like 3 weeks ago, he presented to the emergency room because he had like really bad right upper quadrant pain. And when the physician in the ED saw him, he was like, man, you don't have any history of liver disease. He was sort of looking through his chart. He was like, man, you don't have any history of liver disease. But look at this powerful ascites that this person has. But when you examine the guy further, you did not observe any JVD. You did not hear any crackles in the lungs. It's just literally, they just had like just really prominent ascites. And then let's say you're like, you know what, as a good physician, let me go ahead and tap this ascites, right? So you do a paracentesis, and then you withdraw some of that ascitic fluid, and you measure the gradients, the SAG gradient, right? So like the serum albumin, what was the SAG gradient mean? So the serum ascites albumin gradient. And you're like, man, this is greater than 1.1. So that tells me that, okay, this is likely portal hypertension. That's the cause of this person's ascites, right? But because if you think about it, ascites usually is like chronic alcoholic, blah, 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 the works, right? But if you see acute onset ascites in a patient that, for example, like this one that does not use alcohol, you hopefully are sort of tying all this together, like, oh, this person, old guy, takes a shower, has a ton of itching, or old guy, I mean, if I give you this extra buzzword, everyone will get it right. They say he has a ruddy complexion on physical exam. Hopefully this makes you think about polycythemia vera. Those are essentially the different ways they can present it to you on a test. So polycythemia vera, right? Basically, it's you want to remember that it arises in the setting of a JAK2 mutation. Okay, a JAK2 mutation. I remember polycythemia vera is one of the myeloproliferative disorders, just like CML. But I'll talk about those myeloproliferative disorders in more detail in one of the upcoming podcasts. But basically, polycythemia vera, you have a JAK2 mutation, right? So you begin to make a crap ton of red blood cells, right? So classically, these patients, you go ahead and check their HNH, and their hemoglobin like super high. You'd be like, I don't know, like 19, 20, like just floridly high numbers. Or you check their hematocrit is like 60-70%. If you see that, you really want to think about a P-Vera. And remember that P-Vera classically, right? Again, old guy, ruddy complexion. Basically, if you see that buzzword on tests, don't bother reading the rest of the question. Just find the answer that says polycythemia vera and move on. Two, those guys, they may also have like, they take showers, right? And they have a ton of itching. I've not exactly looked up the mechanism behind that. I'm sure there has to be some mechanism there somewhere. Let's keep going. And then a third thing that they can present with on exams, right? So notice I said, kind of said like, oh, right upper quadrant pain, sudden onset ascites, SAG gradient is greater than 1.1. If you see that, I really hope you're thinking about Budd-Chiari syndrome. Remember, polycythemia vera is a relatively common cause of Budd-Chiari syndrome, right? And remember, in Budd-Chiari syndrome, you have like thrombosis of the hepatic vein, okay? So whenever you have thrombosis of the hepatic vein, right? So sort of think about it, your liver cannot drain blood anymore to the IVC, right? Because the hepatic vein is basically clogged off, right? So obviously those people will have like acute onset like portal hypertension, and they'll have ascites, right? And because they have that acute onset portal hypertension, and they have the ascites, and the ascites is being caused by the portal hypertension, the serum ascites albumin gradient will be greater than 1.1. okay, so do you see how in one question I've talked about oncology, I've talked about hematology, I've talked about GI? So again, that is the way they love to integrate concepts on the USMLE Step 1 exam. So hopefully you can sort of tie all these things together in your mind. So polycythemia vera, but one classic thing you may see on exams is they may ask, oh, what will be true of your levels of erythropoietin in the setting of P vera? Well, hopefully you're saying that it will be low. Okay, basically like the negative feedback mechanisms work, because your body is like, man, this person's red blood cell count is like crazy high, right? So what should you do about it? Well, stop making EPO, right? Because EPO's job is to promote the formation of more and more red blood cells. So so the EPO levels will be really low in the setting of polycythemia vera. And then let me ask you this question. What if a patient has a history of you're like, man, this person has had kidney cancer, this person has had brain cancer, this person has had let me just simplify it, right? So they've had like a history of kidney cancer, they've had a history of brain cancer, they've had a history of And then you check labs on these people, right? And you check a CBC, so like a complete blood count. And again, the hematocrit is like 70%. If you see this, and let's assume this is something that you find in multiple family members. Why not? If you see this, hopefully you're thinking about von Hippel-Lindau disease. It's like a syndrome. It's like a genetic problem with like chromosome 3, if I'm not mistaken, right? Remember, those people tend to get like weird malignancies, right? So they may get like renal cell carcinoma, right? They may get, what is this thing called? It's this brain cancer that produces EPO, hemangioblastoma, right? Hemangioblastoma, you may see that, right? So basically, these people can have multiple cancers that can produce a ton of EPO, right? And because remember, I believe I've actually talked about the pathophysiology in one of my older podcasts, but I think it's maybe like my neurology one of my neurology podcasts. But basically, those people, by having that VHL mutation, they have like issues with like HIF1 alpha, and then they begin to produce like, you know, like just weird stuff with EPO. They begin to produce lots and lots and lots of EPO. And they may also have cancers like renal cell carcinoma or hemangioblastoma that may be associated with the production of erythropoietin. So if you ever see that, that can obviously cause a polycythemia, right? Because they're making a ton of EPO, so they'll make a ton of red blood cells. And I mean, don't forget, right? So like hepatocellular carcinoma, right, can also cause polycythemia, but usually that's associated more with elevations in AFP. Remember, AFP is like the classic tumor marker for hepatocellular carcinoma. And then obviously, if you smoke a ton, right, if you smoke, you sort of become like chronically hypoxic, and that chronic hypoxia will ultimately cause the production of more EPO. Okay, remember, EPO comes from your kidneys, right? So like your peritubular capillary, like the endothelial cells that line your peritubular capillaries in the nephron. And again, right? So if you're chronically hypoxic from like smoking, for example, you can make a crap ton of EPO and you become polycythemic. Okay. And also don't forget, right, that if a patient has renal failure, right, they can get an anemia from that. And the reason they get that anemia, it's usually like a normocytic anemia, is because their kidneys are not working. If your kidneys are not working, well, guess what? You ain't making any EPO. If you're not making any EPO, well, guess what? You're not making any red blood cells. Okay. So again, be able to tie these different pieces of information together. And I mean, obviously, let's say you've not drank water for a couple of days. If I check your CBC, you'll sort of be like hemoconcentrated, because yes, you have the appropriate number of red blood cells, but the volume is not much, right? Because you're like super dehydrated. So that can also cause like a polycythemia. Sometimes they call that like a relative polycythemia. I mean, obviously, for those patients, just give them a ton of fluid and they'll get better, and the CBC anomalies should resolve. Okay. So, one thing I want to talk about, right? So let's assume you get a question about, a kid that has had, I don't know, like bloody diarrhea for like the past like 3 days. And then let's assume you're like, oh man, this kid must have a really bad infection. So you give that kid antibiotics, right? You can already begin to see, yes, maybe this is not a great story, but you give antibiotics. And after you give antibiotics, you notice that this kid begins to have like a lot of fluid retention. You take the kid to the hospital. They check the kid's creatinine. It's like 10. And then you do a CBC. And you notice that the kid's platelet count is like 30. A normal platelet count is usually above 150,000. So it's like 30,000 for this kid. And then the kid's hemoglobin is like 5. If you sort of see all these weird things, right, hopefully you're beginning to put together that, especially being preceded by like bloody diarrhea, and let's assume you recently give the kid antibiotics to treat that bloody diarrhea, I hope you're thinking about EHEC, right, E. coli 0157H7, right, and hemolytic uremic syndrome. So, if you remember from the microbiology podcast, in fact, I know I recently made one big podcast that covered all the gram positives, I guess except TB, and one big podcast that covered all the gram negatives, right? So you can go back and listen to those podcasts and basically review all your bacteria. But back to this, right? So this child, right, bloody diarrhea, and then now they're going into like renal failure, and they have thrombocytopenia, and they have like an anemia. If you see that, hopefully you're thinking of HUS, right? There is also a close cousin of HUS. It's known as TTP, thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura. And I'll sort of talk about the pathophysiology here. But let me mention a few things first, right? The thing is, the primary problem in this child that's beginning to cause many of these, like the thrombocytopenia, the anemia, and the anemia is even called more of like a microangiopathic hemolytic anemia. Again, I'll talk about the pathophys behind all these things shortly. And also like the renal failure. Basically, all these things arise because they are releasing sugar-like toxin into the circulation. And if you notice in the Q stem I gave you, I said that, oh, they give antibiotics and then these things happened. That is why in general, if a kid has EHEC, you don't want to give, so enterohemorrhagic E. coli, you generally do not want to give antibiotics, because if you give antibiotics, you're like, oh, great, I'm killing off this bug. But the thing is, when you kill off the bug, guess what spills into the circulation? The toxin. And when you have spillage of that toxin into the circulation, guess what happens? More injury and more damage, right? So that's why usually, if a patient has EHEC, supportive care is all that you give. You don't want to give antibiotics, but antibiotics actually make it worse, okay? So let's talk about the pathophysiology behind all of this, right? And I think it will make more sense to talk about the pathophys behind TTP first, and then I'll talk about the pathophys behind HUS. Although it's more like, in fact, these days, especially when you get into your third year, they just call it TTP-HUS because it's kind of like a spectrum disorder. It's just that in TTP, usually on USMLE exams, those patients tend to have more like fevers, they tend to have more like neurologic deficits, and they tend to have like the thrombocytopenia, okay? Versus HUS, where they tend to have more the renal failure, right? And they tend to have more of the microangiopathic hemolytic anemia and the thrombocytopenia. So if you're seeing a lot of like neurologic deficits, think more about TTP. If you're seeing more kidney problems, think about HUS, okay? But believe it or not, there are patients with TTP that have kidney failure and they have no neurological issues, okay? So what causes TTP, right? So TTP basically arises when you form like autoantibodies against something called ADAMTS13. The thing is, when you make autoantibodies against ADAMTS13, you may be like, okay, Divine, who cares about that? Like, why do I care? Well, the reason you care is that ADAMTS13, it basically chops up von Willebrand factor, right? So if you make autoantibodies against ADAMTS13, right? Remember, again, antibodies, their constant region, especially IgG and IgM, they can activate, complement, and destroy whatever they bind to. If you destroy ADAMTS13, you're no longer cleaving von Willebrand factor, and that von Willebrand factor will begin to sort of build up in your bloodstream, your circulation. And if that happens, guess what will happen? You'll begin to activate platelets. Now, let me sound a note of warning. In fact, you know what? Let me actually sound a note of warning now, because let me forget this. But basically, you activate platelets, right? You actually do not think of HUS and TTP primarily as primary hemostasis disorders, okay? Do not, for purposes of the USMLE, think of them as secondary hemostasis disorders. So you're really, for the most part, your clotting factors are not really affected in the setting of TTP-HUS. So your PT and your PTT are normal, right? So if they give you like a DIC-like picture and the PT-PTT is normal, you really want to think about TTP-HUS. So back to this, right? So if you're not breaking down von Willebrand factors, your von Willebrand factors sort of hang around for longer. And obviously von Willebrand factor, you already know, can activate platelets, right? Because you have like those, like the adhesion step, the activation step, and the aggregation step that we talked about yesterday. So if you keep activating your platelets in that fashion, right, you become thrombocytopenic at some point, which is obviously not a good thing, right? And the thing is, as a patient becomes thrombocytopenic, and they are forming all these thrombi sticks from like massive platelet activation in their bloodstreams, right? As red blood cells sort of flow through those thrombi sticks, again, they sort of get sheared. And if they get sheared, your LDH will go up. Remember, LDH is part of the cell soup of red blood cells. I already mentioned that earlier. They will also have like a decreased haptoglobin, right? Because think about it, haptoglobin is a hemoglobin binder, right? So whenever you have hemolytic anemia, your haptoglobin, especially like intravascular hemolysis, your haptoglobin typically goes down, right? And then these patients, right, if you want to sort of press this even further, they'll have like an indirect hyperbilirubinemia, right? Because again, heme, if it keeps getting, if it breaks down, you form like biliverdin, and then you ultimately form like indirect bilirubin, right? So these patients will have like an indirect hyperbilirubinemia. So that's kind of like the pathophase behind many of the findings in TTP, right? But you may say, okay, Divine, why is HUS considered along the spectrum of TTP? Well, let me describe this, right? So the thing is, if a patient has EHEC, enteric hemorrhagic E. coli, right? And those bugs spill their toxin, right? So the sugar-like toxin into circulation. Well, why is that bad? The thing is, that sugar-like toxin, it can actually bind to a particular receptor. It's called like the GB3 receptor. If I'm not mistaken, that GB3 receptor actually responds to something known as a ceramide trihexoside. Hopefully you remember from my glycogen, my lysosomal storage diseases podcast, that a ceramide trihexoside is a thing that sort of builds up if a patient has Fabry disease. But basically, that GB3 receptor, the sugar-like toxin is an agonist at that receptor. And when that receptor is activated, a lot of downstream events happen, right? So one of the downstream events that happens is that you have apoptosis of endothelial cells, right? So you may say, okay, Divine, wait, what's the link there with the TTP pathophysiology you just discussed? Well, think about it. If your endothelial cells apoptose, who knows? Maybe you will expose the collagen, the subendothelial collagen that underlies those endothelial cells, and then that can trigger primary hemostasis, and you can basically sort of go down the route of all the problems that accompany TTP, as I discussed, right? So like having like a ton of primary hemostasis and depleting your platelet count. The other thing that happens actually with that signaling cascade of the sugar-like toxin binding to those GB3 receptors is that you also ultimately inactivate ADAMTS13. So in this case, you're not making any autoantibodies against ADAMTS13 as we have in TTP. What you're actually doing is you're literally just inactivating ADAMTS13. And when you inactivate ADAMTS13, right, again, your von Willebrand factor multimers will not be chopped up anymore. So you have massive activation of a primary hemostasis. You form those, so your platelet count will go down because you're depleting platelets, and you'll form all those platelet thrombi sticks in your blood vessels. If you have that happening, right, again, you'll share your red blood cells, so you have a hemolytic anemia. So for those people, I mean, you may even see, like, if you do a blood smear, you can see like schistocytes, right? And again, they'll have high levels of indirect bilirubin. They'll have low levels of haptoglobin. I already described the mechanism behind all those things. And one concern I guess you may have is, Divine, why is HUS more common in kids compared with adults? Here's the reason. The thing is, those GB3 receptors that I said are bound by the sugar-like toxin, you actually find much greater numbers of GB3 receptors in kids in comparison with adults, right? So that sort of answers that question. Another question you may have is, okay, Divine, this is kind of weird. Why does TTP-HUS preferentially affect the brain and the kidneys? The thing is, again, it's all explained by these GB3 receptors. These GB3 receptors are found predominantly, or I mean, they are found in many parts of the body, but you find much larger populations of GB3 receptors in the kidneys, especially like the glomerular capillaries. Remember, your glomerular capillaries, guess what? They are lined by endothelial cells, right? So again, those GB3 receptors, if you have apoptosis of those endothelial cells lining those glomerular capillaries, you can trigger primary hemostasis because you're exposing a lot of that subendothelial collagen at the level of the glomerular capillaries, right? That's why the kidneys can be transiently sort of nuked in the setting of HUS, right? But you also find a large preponderance of those receptors in the central nervous system, okay? So that's why, again, you can get kidney injury and CNS injury in the setting of TTP HUS. So hopefully that sort of clears up a certain things for you, because I always wonder, like, why do you have all these, you know, like, just weird findings in the setting of HUS? Really, if you sort of think through it, the pathophysiology of pretty much all of it makes sense. And really, how would you treat a TTP HUS? I mean, the indicated treatment is like, you do something called like an exchange transfusion. That's like the preferred treatment. You can also do like plasmapheresis. I mean, every so often you'll see them say, oh, you know what, how about we give this person like steroids and IVIG? Those don't really work as well in general. Actually, in fact, I'll say IVIG is usually not given. I mean, you can give steroids, but really the best treatment is like a partial exchange transfusion or plasmapheresis. And as a clinical pro, if you suspect the patient has like TTP, you don't want to sit on it. If they don't get timely treatment, the mortality is 100%. They're going to die for sure if you don't treat it in a timely fashion. So just one of those weird things you sort of want to keep in mind. Keep at the back of your mind for the future. So I think that's all I'm going to say about a TTP HUS. So let's sort of jump up to my next topic. The next thing I guess I want to talk about is, what if you get a question about, you know, like a lady, and they tell you that she has had, they tell you that she's had like multiple miscarriages, right? So like 4, 5, 6 miscarriages, and then they tell you that she has also had like PEs and DVTs, and they tell you, and you do a physical exam on her, and you see like a Miller rash that sort of spares the nasolabial folds, or they tell you that, oh, you know what, this person has had like an autoimmune hemolytic anemia in the past, or they tell you, so basically I'm seeing a lot of rheumatology right now, or they tell you that, oh, you know what, this person has had endocarditis, right, where you basically had like issues on both sides of the valve. So hopefully you're thinking about like Lippmann Sachs endocarditis. This should tell you that this patient has lupus, right? But all these thrombotic issues she's having, right, that basically arises, basically what I'm getting at here is antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, okay? Some people call it APLS, some people call it APS, blah-de-blah-de-blah. So, right, so these patients have a antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, and really, APLS, it's a super weird disease. The truth is, there's not very good understanding of like the cause of APLS and all that stuff, but I guess I can try to give you some sort of give you like a framework to be able to understand this. But first things first, you want to get down the classic presentation, right? So classically, it shows up in females, especially females with a history of lupus on tests, right? They'll have like multiple miscarriages. Sometimes they can even, and I mean, the reason they get these multiple miscarriages is in some cases they can get like thrombosis of the uteroplacental artery, right? So that can sort of cause like death of the fetus. They just get a lot of problems, right? A lot of thrombotic problems. In fact, many times these ladies have to get regular like heparin injections. They need to be on like anticoagulation for life, so that they don't get like PEs and DVTs and whatnot, right? And hopefully you remember, right, from like your med school coursework, if a patient has antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, you may test them for syphilis, and the test may actually come back like falsely positive, right? So like the RPR test, the VDRL test may be positive in these people, but it's like a false positive, right? That's why in general, right, again, just like whenever you do like a screening test in medicine, you almost always want to confirm it in some way, shape, or form, right? So that's why after you do the RPR, VDRL tests, you also want to follow up with like the FTA, ABS tests, or the MHATP tests, right? Those are more treponemal tests. They're more specific for syphilis, right? So that you don't sort of get let down. You're like, oh, crap. RPR, VDR is positive, so this person must have syphilis. No, they don't necessarily have syphilis, okay? And then another weird thing with the antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, right? You want to sort of remember certain bus phrases for the antibodies that may be detectable in the serum. There's like the anti-beta-2 microglobulin antibody. There's like the anti-cardiolipin antibody. Sometimes you may even see just the word lupus anticoagulant on your tests. Those will sort of lead you down that pathway. And they may have in fact, you know what? Let me say some quick pathophysiology here and some quick testing, right? So I said that you can test for APLS by sort of checking for these antibodies in the serum. But there are some weird things that your friends at the MBME sort of go after because they know that people just don't, again, commit the time to, you know, trying to sort of like make sure they have these pieces of information down before they take a test, right? So they sort of count on you to miss these kinds of things, right? So the thing is, the first thing you may think about is you may say, oh, Divine, this is a thrombotic disorder, right? So that means these people would have like a PT or a PTT that is shorter than normal, right? That's not necessarily true. The thing is, when you do these tests in the, like, outside the body, basically, if you sort of, like, test for this, like, lupus anticoagulant, or you check, like, PT-PTT in these patients that have antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, the thing that typically happens is their PT and PTT are actually prolonged. You may say, like, Divine, but this is a thrombotic disorder. How can they have lab values that are consistent with anticoagulation? The reasoning behind that is that basically the autoantibodies that you make in antiphospholipid antibody syndrome actually bind to proteins that I would generically call phospholipid binders. Okay, so the autoantibodies in APLS, they bind to proteins, okay, that I would generically call phospholipid binders. The thing is, if you destroy these phospholipid binding protein, there's a phospholipid binding proteins, you will essentially have like a physiologic excess of phospholipids, and those I think I'm confusing myself here. Let's reset real quick. So the pathophysiology behind antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, so stick with me for a second. The pathophysiology behind antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, no one really understands, but here's the framework I would give you that should help with understanding certain findings with APLS. So, in a test tube, the thought is that the antiphospholipid syndrome autoantibodies bind to phospholipids. Let's sort of simplify it that way. They bind to phospholipids. When you bind to phospholipids, you're basically causing like a decreased activation of the coagulation cascade, right? And your PT and your PTT will go up, right? Because again, you need phospholipids for the coagulation cascade to work. I mean, there are other mechanisms where certain things that encourage the coagulation cascade to like working, like thrombin and whatnot, can be like inhibited by these autoantibodies. But I'm not gonna necessarily go in those directions. Those are not necessary for tests. But in the body, one framework again that I used to understand APLS is that instead of binding to the phospholipids themselves, the APLS autoantibodies bind to proteins that bind to phospholipids, right? So they bind to phospholipid binding proteins. So if you bind to and destroy phospholipid binding proteins, your phospholipids run amok. You basically have the coagulation cascade working better than normal, right? And that increases your thrombotic risk, okay? And the thing is, actually, some of these APLS autoantibodies, they actually like inactivate protein C and protein S. And think about if you inactivate protein C and protein S, you basically have factors 8 and 5, not being inhibited, and again, that will promote thrombosis. Okay, the thing is, all these things I've said, you may see divine, this all sounds weird and odd and wrong, but I promise you, if you actually research the literature, most of what I just said is actually true, right? So these autoantibodies, they have like multiple functions. Like they have some functions that promote thrombosis, they have some functions that are like have like anticoagulant properties, if you may. Okay, so just sort of the way I think of it is, in test tubes they work as anticoagulants, in the body they work as procoagulants. That's probably a simple summary of what I just said. Now the thing is, one test you can actually use in the diagnosis of antiphospholipid antibody syndrome is to do something called like the dilute Russell viper venom type, right? So let me sort of bring to your memories one high yield thing I talked about yesterday, right? So I said that antiphospholipid syndrome, and actually this is a point where you really want to pay attention, this stuff is super high yield for tests. Yesterday I said that if a patient has hemophilias, right, and you perform a mixing study, the mixing study will correct the elevations in PT and PTT, right? But I said that antiphospholipid antibody syndrome is an example of a clotting factor inhibitor disorder. And when you have those kinds of disorders, you do not you basically have antibodies in the serum that can bind clotting factor, right? So if you perform the mixing study, you give like normal plasma that contains all the clotting factors, you still would not have a normalization of your PTT, okay? So that is one fact you want to get down with regards to antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. The PT-PTT will fail to correct when you perform a mixing study. Okay? Because again, right, if a patient has a hemophilia, they are lacking clotting factors, their secondary hemostasis doesn't work as well, so their PT-PTT normally is elevated, right? But if you go ahead and give normal plasma, the PT-PTT would normalize. But if a patient has APLS, the PT-PTT will not normalize because they have autoantibodies in the serum that are kind of like attacking their clotting factors. So that's one fact you want to get down, right? So now you may say, okay, so Divine, why does the dilute Russell viper venom time test help in the assessment of antiphospholipid antibody syndrome? Well, I think one thing that may help is sort of understanding the steps in the test, right? So the thing that happens is that in step one, you basically, you know, take some of the patient's serum and you add viper venom, okay, to that sample of the patient's serum. The thing is, viper venom actually activates factor 10, okay, and that, right, will ultimately lead to the formation of a clot in the final common pathway of secondary hemostasis, right? So the thing is, this is a test tube test. And remember, I said that in test tubes, the antiphospholipid antibodies bind up phospholipids, right? They bind up phospholipids, right? And when they bind up phospholipids, obviously, you will not have coagulation happen as it should, right? So again, obviously, you're not going to like give your patients viper venom, right? It doesn't make any sense, right? You'll have a big lawsuit on your hands. So this is a test tube test. So think in terms of test tubes for this dilute Russell viper venom assay. Okay, so in test tubes, remember the antibodies in APLS work as anticoagulants, okay, because they bind up phospholipids. So again, you take the patient's serum, you add viper venom, you activate factor 10, right? So this patient that has APLS, right, they have these anticoagulants that are sort of acting in their serum. So even if you give something that should normally activate the coagulation cascade by activating factor 10, which in this case is viper venom, you will still have an elevated PT-PTT. You will have issues of forming clot. So if you see those results, you're like, wait, I'm taking my patient's serum, I'm adding viper venom, which should cause like very quick coagulation, and this is not happening. You're like, okay, well, maybe they have a hemophilia, who knows? Maybe they are lacking like a clotting factor, or maybe they have a deficiency of anything, that you find at least in the final common pathway of a secondary hemostasis, right? So like they may have like a deficiency of factor 10 because they're not responding to viper venom, or they're having a deficiency of factor 5 or factor 2 or factor 1, who knows, right? So you're like, okay, let me try to see if I can correct this problem by doing a mixing study. That's actually the second step in the test. So the second step is you give normal plasma, right? Normal plasma has, you know, adequate amounts of clotting factors, right? So the thing is, if a person had like a factor 2 deficiency, for example, that is making them have that abnormal reaction to the viper venom, or factor 10 deficiency, or factor 5 deficiency that is making them have that abnormal reaction to the viper venom, guess what happens? When you give normal serum, this is basically a mixing study, that will correct the problem. Right, that will correct the problem. So that viper venom will then cause activation of the coagulation cascade and you'll form a clot. But the thing is, if a patient has antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, when you give, remember I told you that it's a clotting factor inhibitor disorder, when you give normal plasma, right, that normal plasma, yes, you're like, oh, it contains clotting factors. The thing is, the autoantibodies that exist in APLS will bind up those clotting factors, and you basically will not still form a clot. So you're like, oh crap, okay, this PTPTT is not correcting even with the addition of normal plasma. So you begin to worry that, okay, this is probably a clotting factor inhibitor disorder, likely antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, right? So in step three of this Russell viper venom assay, you then add a crap ton of phospholipid. The thing is, when you add a crap ton of phospholipid, you basically overwhelm those anticoagulant antibodies, right? It's like you're sort of giving them, like it's like you're basically giving phospholipid that binds to all the lupus anticoagulant, right, in APLS. But you still have like extra phospholipid that's left behind for coagulation to work, right? So in the presence of the viper venom and all that stuff, you will then have coagulation happening. So basically the PTPTT will correct with the addition of this phospholipid, and you're like, okay, this basically confirms to me that this patient has antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. So I know like this may not be necessarily high yield for exams, but I think at least for some of the feedback I've gotten some from people that listen to this podcast, people are like, oh, Divine, as much as it's possible, as you tend to do in many of your podcasts, just try to give like some explanation so that certain things are kind of make sense. Okay, so again, let me just summarize this real quick, because I know I sort of blabbered around for the last few minutes. But basically in step one of the assay, you give viper venom, okay, and viper venom normally activates coagulation. So if anything, that should make your PTPTT go down quick and you form a clot fast. But in antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, addition of viper venom actually does not cause the quick formation of clot. You observe a high PTPTT in the presence of a coagulation activator like viper venom. So with that in mind, you're like, okay, crap, this person probably has some kind of disorder from factor 10 down to factor 2, because viper venom is an activator of factor 10. So you're like, okay, let me go ahead and give the person what they may be missing. Let me give them normal plasma that should contain factors 10, factors 5, factors 2, and factors 1, right? So you give normal plasma, and you notice that, you know what, this PTPTT still did not correct, right? So that, so basically, like, you perform a mixing study, right? You perform this mixing study in step 2, and you're like, this thing is still not fixing the problem. So if the problem is still not being fixed, that tells you that, okay, it's not really a deficiency of clotting factors that's making this person's PTPTT not correct. The thing that's happening is you probably have like a clotting factor inhibitor disorder on your hands, right? So in the third step, you basically give a ton of phospholipid, okay? And if you give a ton of phospholipid, that phospholipid will overwhelm the clotting factor inhibitors in the serum, in this case the APLS autoantibodies, and then you have a correction of the PTPTT. In fact, let me put it this way, if you have any questions on this, let me know, and I'll be more than happy to sort of point you in the right direction. And I think to sort of make it obvious, I would also maybe post like 3 slides that just explain what I just said. So you can go back and sort of look at this sort of like in a written format to see if that can help you understand things. But basically, that is how you test for antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. Well, really, if you understand what I just discussed, I promise you, like many of the findings in APLS will not seem so foreign anymore. Okay, so that's all I think I'll say about antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. It's one of those disorders you're going to see on step 1, you're going to see on step 2, you're going to see on your medicine shelf, you're going to see on your OB-GYN shelf, you're going to see on your neuro shelf, you're going to see on step 3, you're going to see on your, if you go into internal medicine, you see it on your board exams. Shows up all the time, okay? So it's one of those weird things you sort of want to, like, you know pretty well. Now, let's assume you get a question about a patient that has, they tell you that they have like these recurring bouts of like abdominal pain, and they have like shooting pain in the extremities, and every now and then they look at their urine and their urine sort of looks like purple, and you know, they just like every now and then they're like depressed. Basically, they have like primarily like a lot of pain, right, like in their bellies, in their extremities, and then they have like many of these like neurological problems, and then they have like purple urine. If you see that, hopefully you're thinking about acute intermittent porphyria. Actually, I talked about this in one of my biochem podcasts or videos, if you may. So what causes AIP, right? So AIP, right, this is unfortunately one of the disorders where you need to remember an enzyme name. Okay, AIP arises when a person has a deficiency of an enzyme I like to call a peanut butter and jelly deaminase. Okay, so PBG deaminase, it's one of the enzymes involved in the synthesis of heme. So the thing that happens is when you have a deficiency of that enzyme, your levels of porphobilinogen build up, right? But also think about it, many things upstream in that pathway also build up as well, the pathway of heme synthesis, like delta aminolevulinic acid actually builds up. And the thing is, ALA, right, so aminolevulinic acid, it's actually toxic to neurons. That is why these people get a lot of like neurological issues, that's one. And they also get like these peripheral neuropathies, because the abdominal pain is actually arising from like neuropathic pain with regards to the abdomen. Okay, so ALA is generally not a great thing. Amylolevulinic acid, I mean, obviously you need it for the synthesis of heme, but once it begins to build up, that is where you can begin to get into a lot of trouble, especially with acute intermittent porphyria. In fact, if you sort of want to take this to like a logical conclusion, if you think about lead poisoning, remember that lead has the ability to inhibit ferrochelatase, right? And something known as ALA dehydratase, right? So if you're inhibiting ferrochelatase and you're inhibiting ALA dehydratase, remember, ALA dehydratase is basically the next enzyme in the synthesis of heme that essentially helps you metabolize the aminolevulinic acid. So if you inhibit ALA dehydratase, your aminolevulinic acid levels will go up. If those levels go up, you'll again begin to have like these neuro-based problems, right? So like neurologic issues, peripheral neuropathy that may be presenting as like abdominal pain and whatnot. In fact, if you look at most USMLE exam questions that relate to lead poisoning, they usually put it like in a pediatric setting, and the classic presentation on USMLE exams is 1, abdominal pain, right? And 2, neurologic problems. So they may say like the kid has like intellectual disability or is not like developmentally appropriate right in school, and then they may tell you that the child lives in like in a house that was built like in 1940 or something like that. Another way they can present it is they may say, oh, that the kids are drinking like water at home, or basically like eating out of like pottery or like pots or plates or whatever that was brought in from like a foreign country, because sometimes pottery may actually contain a lead, especially like pottery from like foreign countries, they may contain like lead that can cause cause lead poisoning, right, if you keep using those utensils. Alternatively, it can also present in an exam question where they describe a person that sort of makes alcohol at home, so they do like moonshining. Because many times, guess what, moonshine, I guess, techniques involve the use of like battery containers, and guess what batteries contain lead. Okay, so those are basically all the classic ways a person could get a lead poisoning on an exam. Now, and I've sort of described how you may potentially explain why abdominal pain and neurologic issues arise in the setting of lead poisoning, because lead inhibits ALE dehydratase and ferrochelatase, and more specifically ALE dehydratase. When you inhibit that, your levels of aminolevulinic acid build up and you get into trouble, because aminolevulinic acid itself is toxic to neurons. And also remember that in lead poisoning, right, you would potentially get if you look at a blood smear, right, you'll see ringed sideroblasts. Again, that should make sense, right, because those ringed sideroblasts are basically like deposits of iron that kind of surround the mitochondria. Because if you think about it, heme synthesis, right, so if you're tying in some biochem here, in the synthesis of heme, you basically have to that last step, I guess, that involves a ferrochelatase, involves iron binding to protoporphyrin to form heme, right? So if ferrochelatase is inhibited by lead, well, guess what? Iron will just sort of hang out around the mitochondria. It's like, oh, where's my protoporphyrin, right? Because you're not even making the protoporphyrin because you've killed ALE dehydratase, right? So you're like, iron is hanging around, it's not doing anything. And when that happens, right, you can begin to see that you have buildups of iron around the mitochondria, because hopefully you don't forget that heme synthesis is one of those weird pathways, right, that occurs in two spots. So everything does not happen in one spot, like, oh, everything happens in the cytosol or everything happens in the mitochondria. No, that is not the case with heme synthesis. In fact, I believe like the first step in heme synthesis occurs in the mitochondria, and then the intermediate steps, if I'm not mistaken, occur in the cytosol, and then that final step involving ferrochelatase, I believe, actually occurs in the mitochondria, right? So it should make sense that iron should sort of like teleport itself to the mitochondria to make that final step happen. So if you're inhibiting ferrochelatase and you cannot have that final step happen, it should make sense that that iron should sort of hang around the mitochondria. That's how you get the ringed sideroblasts. With another thing you may also find in a lead poisoning, right, is you may find the basophilic stippling, right? Remember that basophilic stippling just happens because those are basically like ribonucleoproteins that are sort of like building up, and they sort of scatter all around the cell. Because the thing is, there is actually like a ribonuclease that breaks down those proteins. That ribonuclease is inhibited by lead. So if you inhibit that ribonuclease, you do not break down those ribosomal proteins, and those proteins sort of like hang around the cell. That's how you get the basophilic stippling in lead poisoning. And then if you also, again, I know I'm saying all this like you're like, oh, Divine, this is supposed to be a heme review. But again, I'm just trying to tie things together. One other thing that came to mind is if you think about sideroblastic anemia with isoniazid. Remember, isoniazid depletes your vitamin B6, pyridoxal phosphate. So if you deplete your vitamin B6, right, remember the first step, actually the rate limiting step of heme synthesis involves, so basically you have like succinyl-CoA, if I'm not mistaken, binding up with glycine to form a delta aminolevulinic acid under the action of an enzyme known as ALAS, right? So like ALA synthase. ALA synthase, it so happens, uses vitamin B6 as a cofactor. So if you're taking isoniazid, you deplete your B6, you deplete the cofactor for ALAS. ALAS doesn't work. If ALAS doesn't work, guess what happens? You do not make heme, right? So that's why you get a sideroblastic anemia with isoniazid toxicity. And so you may say, okay, divine, so how do I fix these acute intermittent porphyria problems, right? The thing that happens is that you can give glucose or you can give another substance known as hemin. You may say, divine, this looks low yield. I promise you it's not low yield. These are things that certainly show up on exams. The reasoning behind you giving either glucose or hemin, so hemin is H-E-M-I-N, is that those have the ability to inhibit ALA synthase, okay? And when you inhibit ALA synthase, you basically prevent the buildup of those intermediates that happen when a patient has like the peanut butter and jelly deaminase deficiency. And then, I guess a closely related disease, right, that I'll talk about, that's, I guess, involved in that heme synthesis pathway is a porphyria cutanea tarda, right? This one, you should definitely know it. Remember, it has actually an association with hepatitis C, okay? So if you see a patient with hep C that has, like, increased sweating on their, on, like, the dorsum of their palms, or they have, like, increased, like, hair on the dorsum of their palms, or they have like these like blisters and all that stuff, again, usually on the dorsum of the hands, you really want to think about porphyria cutanea tarda. That arises in the setting of a UROD deficiency. UROD, I believe, stands for uroporphyrinogen decarboxylase. Okay, so for these people, again, it's another heme synthesis problem, but they usually do not have neurologic issues. They usually do not have the abdominal pain. Okay, they usually just have dermatologic problems, right? So, I mean, think about the name of the disease, porphyria cutanea tarda, cutanea, cutaneous, right? So that tells you it's a primarily a dermatologic issue. Again, it arises from a UROD deficiency. And really the way you treat this is you basically bleed out the patient, right? So you perform a phlebotomy, right? So you may say, okay, divine, why would a phlebotomy work? So here's the thing. The reason phlebotomy works is that whenever your body has a deficiency of iron, it actually shuts down the heme synthesis pathway. I'll just simplify that way for you. Whenever you have an iron deficiency, you shut down the synthesis pathway of heme. So if you phlebotomize a patient, guess what happens? You're basically getting rid of iron for them. And when you do that, right, you shut down the heme synthesis pathway, so you don't have the opportunity for those nasty intermediates to build up that cause many of the symptoms that are observed in a porphyria cutanea tarda. I mean, alternatively, right, this is more for step two, you can give hydroxychloroquine. Hydroxychloroquine basically sort of binds up iron. It forms an intermediate with iron, binds up iron in the liver, and then makes, you basically form like a complex that is water soluble, so it can be peed out fairly easily. So you could also use that to treat PCT. But I'll say on exams, think more about a phlebotomy. That's probably like your go-to treatment of a porphyria cutanea tarda. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about those disorders. Let's see. So we are already at an hour and 7 minutes. Let's see. Is there any other weird thing I want to talk about? I talked about the hemophilias yesterday and today. I've talked about like factor 5 Leiden. I talked about how it's like the most common hypercoagulable disorder. And remember, right, patients of Northern European ancestry, right, they classically have those issues. Also don't forget, right, that another classic hypercoagulable disorder you may see on your exam is like the prothrombin like G221A. It sort of sounds like Beverly Hills 90210 or whatever, so it's probably an easy thing to remember. Basically, in this mutation in factor 2, right, it's like a prothrombin mutation. You basically begin to form a ton of a factor 2, and if you form a ton of factor 2, right, you become hypercoagulable because you have more, hopefully, I guess let me use this as a testing moment. What are the functions of factor 2? Right, so we talked about three major functions yesterday. We said that factor 2 helps you convert factor 1 to factor 1a, so fibrinogen to fibrin. And then we said that factor 2 forms a complex with thrombomodulin, right? And that basically helps you convert protein C to activated protein C, right? And if you convert protein C to activated protein C, then that protein C can sort of pair up with protein S and inhibit factors 8 and factors 5, right? We talked about that yesterday. And then the third function of factor 2 that we talked about yesterday was the activation of factor 13. We said that factor 2 converts factor 13 to factor 13A. And we said that factor 13A is involved in the formation of awesome crosslinks amongst like fibrin, right? So you form an even stronger platelet plaque. Okay, so hopefully you remember all those things from yesterday. And then we also talked about like nephrotic syndrome and like peeing out your antithrombin 3, which can basically make you hypercoagulable because you're no longer inhibiting factors 10 and 2, right? We talked about that yesterday. And then if you listen to the Heme Pharmacology podcast, right, so I talked about warfarin in that podcast where I said that, oh, before you start a patient on warfarin for the first time, you need to place them on heparin first, right? And I explained the reasoning behind that, right? Remember, the way warfarin works is that it inhibits a vitamin K epoxide reductase. So when you have that, you no longer have the gamma carboxylation of factors 2, 7, 9, 10 and protein CNS, right? So basically six things. The thing is, the first four things, factors 2, 7, 9, and 10, those are procoagulants, and then protein CNS, right? Because they inhibit factors 8 and 5, those are anticoagulants. But it so happens that proteins CNS have a shorter half-life than factors 2, 7, 9, and 10, okay? So if you give warfarin and you basically kill the formation of gamma carboxylated factors 2, 7, 9, and 10, protein CNS, then whatever pool, like, so let's say, oh, like, right the second before you give the warfarin, right, whatever pool of factors 2, 7, 9, and 10, and protein CNS that have been gamma carboxylated that exists, the first one that will sort of, like, decrease in concentration in your circulation is protein CNS, because they have a shorter half-life, okay? So if protein CNS sort of tank out of your circulation, you then transiently have this period where proteins, factors 2, 7, 9, and 10 are sort of working on a pulse, right? So they are basically working on a pulse because there's no protein CNS to sort of counter some of their, some of their procoagulant effects. So that is why warfarin, when you take warfarin, you have like a transient hypercoagulability. That is why you have to bridge those patients with heparin first, okay? So that you sort of dumb down that transient hypercoagulability. So what if you had a disorder, right, where you had like a deficiency of protein C or protein S? I actually talked about this yesterday, right? If you have a deficiency of protein C or protein S, right, it's like those warfarin effects will be hyperemphasized, if you may, right? Because it's like, oh, you give warfarin, right? So normally, at least you have like some protein C and S that will help you for like maybe a few hours before you then have that transient hypercoagulability of factors 2, 7, 9, and 10. Well, guess what? If you have a protein C and S deficiency, you have like no protein C or protein S that would help you transiently, right? Before you get to that transient warfarin hypercoagulability from factors 2, 7, 9, and 10, right? So patients with protein C and S deficiency, they generally tend to have a higher risk of like skin necrosis, for example, with the administration of warfarin. That's a classic way it presents on exams. Let's see, is there any other thing? So let me look at my outline here of things I wanted to discuss. I mean, there's this weird thing I saw in first aid about like hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis. It's just one of those, weird things you just want to know a few things about. Classically, it shows up in people that have like EBV or, it can also show up as like a genetic disorder where people sort of have issues with like activating like natural killer cells appropriately and whatnot. But really, the big thing I will say you want to look out for on exams is hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis is like a cytokine storm syndrome. So basically, you have like your macrophages and your CD8 positive T cells sort of just overdoing their job. They're just like hyperactivated. And you also release a lot of like cytokines and chemokines that cause a lot of inflammation. And the classic thing that you may see on exams is that you go ahead and do like a blood smear or like take like a bone marrow aspirate, and you see like macrophages basically like sort of chewing up red blood cells and like red blood cell precursors. That's like a classic finding if you aspirate the bone marrow. And really the only way you can treat this disorder is by doing like a stem cell transplant. If not, the mortality is like 50%. And one, I guess, parallel I can sort of make here is, right, so I told you that this is one of those like weird disorders where you release a ton of cytokines, right? So it's like a cytokine storm disorder. The thing is, let me sort of make some reference to some pharmacology, because this is one of those weird things, again, that you may sort of need to be able to tie together on an exam, right? So if you remember I think it was like the immunopharmacology podcast, I talked about this drug, OKT3, that's a Miromonab. Basically, it's like a monoclonal antibody against like the CD3 receptor, right? The thing is, OKT3, aka Miromonab, it's a drug that's used as an immunosuppressant. It works really well. But the thing is, in many cases, there have been many like reported cases of patients like having like something called like a first dose, inflammation that occurs whenever you take that drug. Because think about it, right? CD3 is a receptor you find on many T cells. If you activate CD3, right, you activate T cells, they release a crap ton of cytokine. Right, so the thing is that initial binding of the monoclonal antibody to CD3 may cause like a massive release of cytokines, and that can cause a lot of trouble. Okay, but over time you then basically deplete your T cell population with Miromonab. But so that's something you sort of watch out for, right? So if, for example, if you're giving your patients like Miromonab in the future, you probably want to observe them in the hospital for a while. You don't just like, yeah, like send them home, because if they have like that's like cytokine storm, they can run into trouble and die relatively quickly. Okay, so that's sort of like a parallel with like the hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis. You basically have like a cytokine storm because you have like macrophages that are just working too crazy. Okay, so that's just one of those weird things you sort of want to keep at the back of your mind. And I guess some other things that I have on my list here to discuss that I did not discuss yesterday, I guess, let's see, how do I do this? Let me sort of describe these things as like case scenarios, right? So we'll just walk through a couple of them, right? So let's assume you get a question about a patient that is from some Northern European country, okay? And they tell you that this person just has like, a ton of, they just sort of have like chronic anemia. Like their hemoglobin is always like 8 or like 7.5 or something like that. And they tell you that, oh, you know what, this is not the only person in the family that has that problem. Like if you look at dad also had the problem. If you look at granddad also had the problem. Like the problem does not appear to be skipping generations. And then they tell you that, oh, you do like red blood cell studies and you notice that the mean corpuscular hemoglobin concentration, right? So the MCHC is high. If you see that, hopefully you're thinking about hereditary spherocytosis. Remember that arises because people have like spectrin or like anchoring defects. Spectrin and anchoring are sort of like part of the red blood cell cytoskeleton. It's an autosomal dominant disorder. That's why it doesn't skip generations. Okay. And obviously, right, if you do like a blood smear, you'll see like red blood cells that lack central pallor. If you see that, think about hereditary spherocytosis. And remember that those spherocytes, you don't only find them in like hereditary spherocytosis, you can also find them in like warm agglutinin disease, right, where a patient has like warm autoimmune hemolytic anemia. That's where you have like IgG antibodies against your red blood cells. I'll talk about that in a different podcast. Okay, so what if you get a question about a patient that, they have like chronic anemias, and let's say you do like a x-ray of their an x-ray of their skull, right, and you find this weird hair on end appearance, and let's say that these patients have just recurrent, like let's say they've had like just really, really bad Neisseria infections, and they've had like strep pneumosepsis before. Hopefully this makes you think about what is it called? sickle cell disease, right? So they've basically infarcted their spleens. Remember, if you infarct your spleen, you won't be able to defend yourself against the encapsulated organisms, right? Like Neisseria meningitidis or strep pneumo. In fact, strep pneumo is probably the most common cause of sepsis in patients with a sickle cell disease. So if a patient has like a sickle cell disease, right, and you do a blood smear on them, right, obviously you find sickle cells, boohoo. But another thing you may also find is your How Old Jolly Buddies, right? Because remember, for those patients, your How Old Jolly Buddies are just basically like DNA contents of your red blood cells that should ideally be removed by like macrophages from your spleen. But if you have sickle cell disease, you've killed your spleen. So those splenic macrophages, basically, they are not around anymore. So you cannot remove those How Old Jolly Buddies, right? So you tend to find that in patients that have a sickle cell disease. Now, what if you get a question about a patient that, you know, has, let's say like many people in the family have the same issue, right? So many of them go blind, like at the age of like, 17, 18, and they have like walking problems, right? So they have like ataxia, and they have like a secondary hyperparathyroidism, if you may, and you measure their levels of blood cholesterol and it's like super, super low. If you see this, I hope you're thinking about like A-beta lipoproteinemia, right? So it's like an autosomal recessive disease where people are not, you know, they have like mutations in like a protein known as MTTP. But basically, the big thing that happens is they don't have the ability to form ApoB48 and ApoB100. So guess what? If you have those problems, well, you will not be able to make VLDL and you will not be able to make chylomicrons, right? So these people will begin to have like a cluster of issues where they have trouble reabsorbing fat-soluble vitamins and fats in general, right? So they may have like steatorrhea because their fats just sort of hang out in the GI tract and they poop it out. Remember, fats cause diarrhea. And they have like blindness and ataxia and all that stuff because they're essentially having issues with the fat-soluble vitamins, right? So they'll have the blindness because they're not reabsorbing vitamin A. They'll have the secondary hyperparathyroidism because they're not reabsorbing vitamin D. They will have ataxia because remember, if you want your cerebellum to function appropriately, you need vitamin E for that. And they may also have like a ton of bleeding, right? Because they're not reabsorbing vitamin K, okay? So that's a bit of lipoproteinemia, right? But think about it. Your cells in your body depend very heavily on phospholipids, right, which are derived from fat, right? They depend heavily on phospholipids for their cell membrane integrity, right? So if you have A-beta lipoproteinemia, you can begin to imagine that your cell membranes will not have like the appropriate amount of integrity. So you will observe something known as acanthocytosis on a blood smear, where you basically have like squiggly looking red blood cells. And then I think that's all I'm going to talk about today. I don't want this to go on for longer than it has. But next time we meet, I'll say a lot about like red blood cell problems and maybe begin to get into the cancers. Okay, but I promise this will be a series of podcasts, but by the end, you'll be a hemonc expert. And again, my ultimate goal is to cover everything that's discussed in First Aid for the USMLE Step 1 2019. So the way I sort of develop my outline, like my topic list, is I basically like look at First Aid and say, okay, this is like a list of the topics that I described in First Aid, but I try to present them in like a case-based format. And then I also try to give you pathophysiology, right? Because as you know, your First Aid book, it's a great book, contains everything you need to know for step one, but it doesn't necessarily have context, right? So that's my job. My job is to provide context and also show you the way those that knowledge can be tested. And again, to round up, as I always do at the end of my podcasts, I offer one-on-one private tutoring for the all the USMLE exams, step one, 2CS, 2CK, step three, med school exams, like your preclinical tests, your third year exams, or organic chemistry. If you need tutoring with that, let's say you have like a buddy or whatever that's in undergrad, that's pre-med. And then I also prepare applications like AMCAS, ERAS applications. So applications for med school, applications for residency. I do like mock interviews because I have a lot of admissions committee experience. So if you ever need any of those things, just reach out to me through the website or send me an email or whatever, and I'll get back with you. So I wish you the best. Have a wonderful day. This is, again, one of those podcasts I'm making in the wee hours of the, like, early hours of the morning. This seems to be a good time. But I'll see you guys in the next podcast. Have a wonderful day. God bless. And I hope everyone enjoyed Valentine's Day. I'll see you next time. Thank you.